Joe Lanza's Baroque Favorites, Program Notes, written by Jeff Wall, read by Sasha Gorbaso. George Friedrich Handel, 1684 to 1759, a pastiche. As an overture to tonight's concert, London Symphonia concertmaster Joe Lanza has chosen three short excerpts from the works of George Friedrich Handel to form a brief suite. The first selection, from the Serenata Parnasso in Festa, for the 1734 wedding of Anna, Princess Royal, provides an opening in the style of a French overture. Handel's very first opera, Elmira, composed in Hamburg at the age of 19, is the source of the following Sarabanda, while the conclusion is a gigue from Terpsichore, an opera ballet written as a prologue to the 1734 London revival of his opera, Il Pastor Fido, or The Faithful Shepherd. And by way of disambiguation, it has nothing to do with a dog. Francesco Gemignani, 1687 to 1762, Concerto Grosso No. 4, after Arcangelo Corelli's Trio Sonata, Opus 3, No. 4. Arcangelo Corelli, 1653 to 1713, in addition to being one of the foremost violinists of his time, was also one of its most influential composers. His pupils included two of the most prominent 18th-century Italian violinists, Pietro Locatelli, who took the technique of playing to new heights of difficulty, and Francesco Gemignani, who continued the Corelli tradition of making virtuosity subservient to form and expression. Gemignani settled in England in 1714, where, violinistically, he was a much larger frog in the pond, and where his connection to Corelli was valued the more, as the late master's music was then the rage. Gemignani's Concerto Grosso transcriptions of Corelli's Opus 3 trio sonatas were issued in 1735. The originals, published in 1689, consist only of two violin parts and a bass line with figures indicating the intended harmony. Gemignani's task was not only to add interesting inner voices, but also to create meaningful contrast between the solo group, or concertino, and the orchestral strings. This he managed skillfully, while remaining true to the text and spirit of his models, his only innovation being to add a viola to the concertino, and thereby turn it from a string trio into a string quartet. The brief B minor Concerto Grosso is a standard Baroque pattern of four movements, alternating slow and fast tempos. The elegant third movement, Adagio, is linked to the final presto by a familiar three-chord formula ending with a pause, permitting the first violinist to improvise a brief cadenza if desired. Johann Sebastian Bach, 1685 to 1750. Orchestral Suite No. 2, A minor version with violin solo. J.S. Bach's output is certainly some of the most closely examined music in existence, and sometimes not in existence. Examples abound of his reuse in his many church cantatas of movements from other compositions. The Brandenburg Concertos, for instance, and it is known from records of his estate that much of his output has been lost. And yet, with ever newer investigative techniques, and no little cunning, it has been possible for musicologists to reconstruct some of these missing pieces convincingly, if not precisely. Bach's position as cantor of Leipzig St. Thomas Church from 1723 until his death required a steady production of music for church services. And consequently, much of his purely orchestral music was presumed a product of his previous appointments as Kapellmeister to the court in Köthen. But analysis of his music paper, evolving penmanship, and maturing style has proven that assumption to be unreliable. In fact, from 1729 until 1736, and then again in 1739, Bach's Leipzig career included supervision of the Collegium Musicum, an instrumental society founded by Georg Philipp Telemann for the public performance of secular music. Telemann himself wrote literally hundreds of orchestral suites, so Bach's four known suites would have been typical fare for these concerts, and it is now believed that the second and third suites were composed for them. And that's not all. Taking Bach's own example of recasting his earlier violin concertos as concertos for harpsichord, scholars examining his other extant instrumental works have determined that some, and maybe most of them, are actually reworkings of previous compositions for other instruments, in which case Bach's surviving instrumental pieces are more likely to be Leipzig versions of earlier material, destined for the Collegium concerts at Zimmermann's Coffee House. Under these circumstances, the presence of a solo flute throughout the suite number 2 attracted attention, since none of the other three suites comparably suggests a concerto. Examination of the flute part has revealed its range and figuration to be eminently violinistic when transposed down a tone to A minor from its flute-friendly B minor. Therefore, the eminent American musicologist and conductor Joshua Rifkin has arranged the suite in that key for violin and strings as a putative original version later adapted for a flautist of considerable ability, perhaps a visiting artist. Bach's 1739 return to the leadership of the Collegium Musicum has been proposed as a logical occasion for such an event, which would make the second suite, in effect, the fourth. However, the identity of a soloist remains speculative, as does the date of, or even existence of, an earlier score. Those who are unfamiliar with the flute version of the suite need have no qualms about this one. Apart from a few octave displacements and the change of instrumental timbre, the notes themselves have not been altered. Mr. Rifkin does find that the lower pitch and greater uniformity of tone color impart a new gravitas to the piece. But as Bach himself displayed no compunction in recasting his compositions for available resources, there can be no serious objection to others doing the same. So, tonight, London Symphonia has programmed a reverse-engineered transcription for violin and strings of a postulated lost earlier version of Bach Suite No. 2 for flute and strings. Enjoy! Charles Aveson, 1709-1770. Concerto Grosso No. 4, in A minor, after Domenico Scarlatti. Newcastle organist, composer, and essayist Charles Aveson, like many an Englishman, had definite opinions on music. He did not like Vivaldi, only a fit amusement for children, nor indeed for these if ever they are intended to be led to a just taste. Handel, he reckoned, to be a lesser composer than Marcello and Gemignani, who had apparently been Aveson's teacher. However, he did like Domenico Scarlatti, 1685-1757, at least enough to seek out and arrange for strings several dozen of his harpsichord sonatas. The process involves selecting and collating these single-movement works into standard four-movement patterns of slow-fast, slow-fast, and scoring them for the concerto grosso, two solo violins and cello plus string orchestra. Interestingly, he did not follow Gemignani in adding a viola to the concertino. Since most of the Scarlatti sonatas in print were fast movements, Aveson had to obtain manuscripts of unpublished works to supply sufficient slow movements. In fact, he was not entirely successful, and accordingly presented as slow movements some sonatas originally intended to be quick. The publication of the whole set by subscription in 1744 attests to Scarlatti's popularity in England at the time. An Italian by birth and training, son of the renowned Alessandro Scarlatti, Domenico had landed at the Spanish court in Madrid in 1729. Several volumes drawn from his 555 harpsichord sonatas had appeared in England beginning in 1738. It might be considered somewhat ironic to have a harpsichordist playing continuo to 16 string players when he might do the whole job himself, but Aveson had a ready explanation. These lessons for harpsichord being extremely difficult and many delightful passages entirely disguised, either with capricious divisions or an unnecessary repetition in many places, few performers are able to execute them with that taste and correctness they require. Therefore, the forming them into parts and taking off the mask which concealed their natural beauty and excellency will not only more effectually express that pleasing air in sweet succession of harmony, so peculiar to the compositions of this author, but render them more easy and familiar to the instrument for which they were first intended. This, to use a Northern English expression often directed toward overly clever little boys, could be looked on as teaching your grandmother to suck eggs. However, Scarlatti never had a chance to express himself on the matter, and posterity has decided that Aveson's confident opinion of his own work is justified. In the fourth concerto, unlike some of the others, the first violin part remains quite within the normal concerto grosso range of difficulty. One can readily hear the keyboard origins of the second movement in the opening rapid five-finger cascades. the initially gloomy key of A minor, is alleviated by the third movement in C major, apparently of Avison's own composition, and ultimately dispelled by the final movement's sly deke into A major. Antonio Vivaldi, 1678-1741. Concerto for Violin and Strings in E minor, RV 278. Of Vivaldi's 108 surviving solo violin concertos, probably only five are widely known. The Four Seasons concertos, and the one included in the Suzuki Violin Chorus, of course. Perhaps two dozen others have been recorded with some frequency because of some outstanding feature, a nickname, or a bizarre tuning scheme, or because they were published in the same volume as the aforementioned five. That leaves a lot of great music looking for ears. Surprisingly, 65 of these concertos were published in Vivaldi's lifetime, a time in which publication was still an expensive process, so we know they were popular. It was also common for popular works to circulate in manuscript copies at that time, both sanctioned and bootlegged. In general, though, the concertos that were not part of a published collection have remained obscure, irrespective of their artistic worth. The present concerto is just such a work. It has been assigned a date of 1730, a year that the Venetian Vivaldi spent in Bohemia. This may be irrelevant, for what occasioned the writing of this turbulent and tragic concerto, one of Vivaldi's longest, is unknown. As a matter of pure speculation, it could have been intended for performance between the acts of an opera, possibly by Vivaldi himself. Certainly, the opening suggests the beginning of a vocal scene. Only at the end of this rather long orchestral ritornello do the dramatic outbursts and sighs settle into the regular phrases and scales of the familiar Vivaldi concerto introduction. With the entry of the soloist, the basses fall silent. The violin line comments on rather than quotes the expressive main theme of the tutti. Appearances throughout the concerto of an unnaturally lowered second degree of the scale, i.e. re and the sol fa syllables, contribute to the sense of anguish. The second movement, with its achingly dissonant harmonies, chromatic lines, and constant dotted rhythmic accompaniment, speaks a language of suffering, made familiar by the sacred oratorios of Bach and Handel. The violin has a simple line, made for tasteful decoration. A remarkable number of contrasting figures of different lengths and volumes are strung together in the ritornello of the finale, including broken arpeggios, a striking descending chromatic scale embedded in a jagged figuration, and a rising scrap of gallant melody that might almost be by Gluck. Indeed, in its spare texture and limited counterpoint, the concerto is quite forward-looking. Its intensity and singularity of emotional effect are, however, completely Baroque.